From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Peter Sakrovsky is a Jew who grew up in post-war Austria. His book, Born Guilty, explores a subject that's haunted him for years, how the sons and daughters of Nazis have dealt with their parents' participation in the Holocaust. Coming up, Sakrovsky shares some of his findings. I also speak with novelist and New Yorker cartoonist William Hamilton. His work lampoons the rich. As for Hamilton, he's mastered the art of looking rich without having any money. And classical music critic Lord Schwartz has a review of several new compact disc reissues featuring cellist Pablo Casals. They're the first CD reissues featuring the popular cellist. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Peter Sakrovsky is a Jew who grew up in post-war Austria. Many of his schoolmates were the sons and daughters of Nazis. How do the children of killers live together in the same country with the children of victims? This question has haunted him for years. He posed the question to the children of Jewish survivors in his book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Young Jews in Germany and Austria Today. Sakrovsky gave himself a more difficult task for his new book, Born Guilty. He interviewed the sons and daughters of Nazis and probed their feelings about their parents' participation in the extermination of Jews. Peter Sakrovsky lives in Austria, where he's a freelance writer and the author of several best-selling books published in German. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. He told me why he followed up his book on the children of survivors with a book from the perspective of men and women whose parents were Nazis.
When I finished the other book, 1985, after it came out, I was interested in what I called the other side. And I was looking for books and studies, and I didn't find one. So it was almost a reaction to the silence that I started to interview people whom I know and from whom I know that they came from Nazi families, who described their parents before as being involved in the SS or in the Nazi movement. And this is how everything started. So I actually started in my own surrounding, because I lived in Berlin at that time, and started to talk to people whom I know.
You grew up in Austria, going to school with the children of former Nazis. Did you think about that a lot when you were growing up? And how in what ways did that influence the friendships that you made?
When I think back, it was never a question. It was never discussed between friends of mine and me. It was never discussed in school with other boys or girls. Maybe it was at the age when I started to study in Austria. I started to ask other people, well, what did your father do during the war? Or was this ever discussed in your family? This was about the age when I started to ask questions, because I was always used to tell what happened to my parents, but they never told me something about their parents. But when I think back, it was never a problem, I would say, before I was maybe 20 or 22 or 23.
What made it a problem when it hadn't been one before?
My questions made it a problem. For instance, I remember a situation when I was in London as a student. There was a German student, and we went out, and I told her the story about my parents who stayed in London during the war, and then I asked her, what did your father do? And she said, well, he was in the SS. Finished. And so, well, and then I started to ask questions. Well, what did you do there? She said, I don't know. She said, did you ask him where he was? She said, no. I said, was this never discussed in your family, what the father did? She said, no. Then I asked her, well, maybe he's a murderer. Maybe he was involved in the worst war crimes. Then she says, well, I never asked him. And this is how all this kind of conversation started.
So you wanted to find out some of the questions that even the children of former Nazis were afraid to find out or didn't know about.
I was interested. It was impossible for me to imagine that in these families nobody ever talked about all this.
You interviewed several children who were from Nazi families. And did you find that most of them were willing to talk with you about this, especially since they knew that you were Jewish and that it would be talking to someone who would probably be passing judgment on them in a way that an interviewer who was also a son or a daughter of Germans who had been in the Nazi movement wouldn't be passing judgment on them?
It was very different. Some of them really wanted to talk because they there was a lot of pressure on them because they have never talked before about that, and they were very glad that they were able to talk. It was a very interesting situation sometimes. I always made the interviews in telephone in hotel rooms, and sometimes I had the microphone there and the tape recorder, and they started to talk and talk and talk and couldn't stop. And others I called and wanted to persuade them and ask them if they would give me an interview, and they said, no, I don't want to talk to you because I know what you expect me to say. So they thought that I expect from them that they are going to criticize their parents, which was not true. I was interested in their relationship to the parents.
You did these interviews in hotel rooms that would be on neutral ground?
Yes, I never wanted to visit them at home. And I never talked to the parents. I only talked to the children.
My guest is Peter Sikorsky, and we're talking about his new book, Born Guilty, Children of Nazi Families. And Sikorsky is himself an Austrian who is Jewish. One of the things that really surprised me reading through your interviews is how little so many of the people who you interviewed knew about at what level their parents participated in the war and in the Nazi death camps. How did they end up growing up and knowing so little? Is it that they didn't want to know, that their parents didn't want to talk about it?
Well, almost all of them described the first 15 years of their life that they accepted everything that came from the parents. So if the father said, well, I was a soldier like everybody else, they accepted it. And very often they got the different information from outside. Or they found documents, or they found a picture. And then, you know, when they were 15 or 16, they learned in school about the SS, the war and everything. So they came home and looked at the picture where the father was in an SS uniform. So they asked the father, well, what kind of uniform is this? And then they started to give answers, but they always defended themselves. As one girl, one woman describes her situation in the book, that she, when she was 14, a letter came, and it came out that the father was brought to court because it was the member of the SS guard in a concentration camp. Again, the information came from outside. And then these children confronted their parents. They said, well, what is the truth now? You always told me this, and now I hear this. And then the parents constantly defended themselves. But very soon then the children found out that most of the parents were lying about their past. There was no single interview I made where a man or a woman told me I knew exactly what my parents did. I knew exactly what my father did. It was always like a fog, you know. They could always. There was no clear picture about the past of the parents.
Although this kind of information about the parents' participation in the war wasn't passed on, was there any anti-Semitism that was passed on from the parents to the children?
There was always anti-Semitism or anti-Semitic statements by the parents, but not only against the Jews. I mean, all of the children described their parents as people who remain in their in the way of thinking after 1945. So they described them as being Nazis also when the Nazi time was over. So it was against, it was all the statements against criminals, against Jews, against Russians, very often also against Americans. The typical way of thinking for a Nazi continued in the families. And then some of them even describe themselves as children as being victims of Nazis because they had to live with Nazi parents. For instance, one told me in an interview that he feels like he was the Jew in the family.
And he said that he thought you were better off than he was.
Yeah, this is one of the most ridiculous interviews I made because he really had a desire of being a victim. He wanted to prove me that he was the real victim because for me, he told me, for you the war is over. Your parents survived. And you're living with at least you're living with parents who are no Nazi. But I had to live with Nazis till I left at home, which was 20 years after the war.
Well, that's one extreme that emerged, and there's two other extremes, I think, that emerged. On the one hand, you had some of the children who really broke off from their parents and felt that they just couldn't deal with, that they didn't want to be a part of their parents' complicity in the war. And these are the children who didn't even invite their parents to their own weddings. On the other side, you have someone like the woman who you call Stephanie, who feels that the war criminals have been tried. She's not guilty. She had nothing to do with it. And she really thinks her sister is crazy for having joined all these new peace groups. And I think you say at the end of your book that it's this interview with the woman who feels no guilt whatsoever, that was the most controversial of all the interviews when the book was published in Germany.
Yes, she's interesting because she's 19 years old. She's actually the third generation, and she's talking about her grandfather, who was executed in Nuremberg. The problem with the new generation now is that many of them don't accept that they are children or grandchildren of Nazis or war criminals. They say, and the problem of this generation is that the whole education of the third generation was very different to the second generation. Today in school, like Stephanie says in her interview, they see films of concentration camps, they see pictures, they hear from the teachers almost every day, every week, and they can't hear it anymore. They say, why do we have to listen to all this every day, every week, every year? Why do I have to see all these pictures? I didn't do anything, my friends didn't do anything, even my parents didn't do anything because they were born after the war. So why should I be confronted with all this constantly? And in a way, she's quite right, I think, even if this would sound strange, because you have a teacher generation today in Germany who show it in a very powerful way to children who are between maybe 15 and 18, who really can't deal with the whole situation. They don't know what to do with it. And again, you have a teacher generation today who do not talk about it as being a part of their own family history, of the history of the town, of the history of the school, talking about the teachers who worked. You know, it's always presented as a part of the history lesson in Germany. And I think today, you know, Germans always talk about the collective guilt. You know, they don't want to accept collective guilt. But there is much more work done with guilt now in the German schools and in among the Germans than from outside into German.
Well, you also express a concern about collective amnesia.
Yeah. Well, this is the other side of collective guilt. You know, when everybody's guilty, nobody's guilty. This is a ridiculous statement. And when I went to school, the Holocaust, the Second World War, was no question. Nobody talked about it. There was no information at all. I didn't learn about the Holocaust in school. Nobody learned in the 50s and the 60s. But what is now going on, I think, is the opposite, which is as worse as what they did before.
Your book has been published in Germany. It's also been published in Austria. And you say that the reaction in Germany was the book was very controversial. Everybody was talking about it. You were getting called up to participate in panel discussions and to do a lot of public speaking. But when the book was published in Austria, there was no such reaction. It was kind of greeted with quiet. What do you think is responsible for the different receptions your book has gotten, or the subject has gotten, in both countries?
Well, Austria still sees itself today as being the first victim of the Nazis. And when you publish a book about children of Nazis, the first reaction is say, well, we didn't have any Nazis, it were the Germans.
I should mention that the Nazis invaded Austria exactly 50 years ago.
Yeah. And the problem is that Austria never accepted their own responsibility in the whole in the participation in the Holocaust and in the Second World War, and it is slowly starting, and that during the last 2 years that scientists and politicians and all kinds of different groups are rewriting Austrian history concerning these years. And so the reaction in Austria was very, very was silence. It was unbelievable. only when last November, Born Guilty, the book, also came out as a play in Vienna. And it was a very important, very big theater who put it on stage. Then a lot of people reacted, and the play was always sold out. The play was a great success. And then also the press started to write about it.
I want to talk with you more about your research and about your own life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Austrian writer Peter Sakrowski, whose new book, Born Guilty, is based on his interviews with the children of former Nazis. He lives in Austria now. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Austrian writer Peter Sakrowski is my guest, author of Born Guilty, Children of Nazi Families. We've talked a little bit about some of the responses you got from the people who you interviewed. I'm interested in your responses to what they told you. I get the impression from your book that you really have no understanding or sympathy for those children who condemn what their parents did but feel sorry for themselves. Would you explain that? I feel that you're not interested in empathizing with them.
Well, the whole work and all the interviews helped me to understand in sometimes what difficult situation they are. But I have difficulties in feeling sorry for them, especially those who always presented themselves as being victims of their parents. I mean, we're talking today about men and women who are in the 40s, and some of them moved out, left home when they were 18 or 20, or when they finished study, and they had at least between 10 and 20 years. They had time to develop their own life and to emancipate themselves. And some of them still say everything that they are today is a result of the treatment and the education, the influence of their parents. And with this situation, I had really difficulties.
You write that for the children of Nazis, the unconditional love of parents is an indulgence they cannot afford. Do you think that the children of Nazi parents should, openly condemn their parents and break with them in some way?
No, I never expected this. And I think what I wanted to say is that if you don't question, and if you don't ask your parents what they did, if you don't take the risk to get an answer that is very uncomfortable for you, then you have no right to accept your parents like they are today. One woman, for instance, told me in an interview that she doesn't want to talk to her mother anymore because she has the feeling that that her mother lied all the years. So I asked her, what was so terrible what your mother did? And she said, this is not the question what they did during the war. It's the problem what she did afterwards when she lived together with me. And then she said, I would accept her, I would love her, even if she would have been a member of the guard in a concentration camp, if she wouldn't have lied to me. If she would have told me I was young at that time, what I did was wrong, I recognize today what I did, and I'm going to try to do everything that you are different to me. Then she said, I would be glad to have a mother like this. So it's not the problem what they did. All the problems the children that of the Nazis have with their parents today is because of how they behaved after the war, because they lied to the children, because they never changed after 45. This is the problem, the relationship to the Nazi parents.
I'm interested in what it was like for you growing up in Austria as a Jew after the war. Both of your parents fled their countries either right before or right after the Nazis invaded. Your father was from Austria. He left his parents to flee the country to escape the Nazis. Your mother was from Prague. She left her mother to flee the Nazis. And your grandparents all were killed by the Nazis, but your parents were survivors.
Yes.
Why did they go to Austria after the war was over. I think they'd been living in Belgium, is that right?
No, they lived in England. In London. Okay. My father was a British soldier, and he came back in the British uniform. And, well, they had the idea, they were very young, they were 22 and 23 after the war, and they had the idea that there is a chance to build up a new Austria with a new identity.
With and a new Jewish community?
No, not so much with the Jewish community. This was not the question. You know, my father always told me when he was in London, there was like a community of victims. And it doesn't matter if somebody was Jewish or he was Catholics and therefore left the country, or he was a communist. So shortly after the war, there was their friends that were from. They had to leave the country for many different reasons, and this was a basic community. My parents always thought would be also a basic for the rebuild or a new Austria. Which was not true, we know today, because Austria wasn't interested in the immigrants who came back. It were the more or less the old Nazis who continued to be in power, and they built the new Austria.
Are you ever sorry that they decided to return to Austria and that you ended up growing up Jewish among former Nazis and the children of former Nazis?
Well, this is a question that's going on in our family since really I can't think back. I always ask them, why didn't you stay in London? And they say, well, we feel Austrian. And I criticized them very much till about 10 years ago. Today I realize that I'm also Austrian. You know, the family of my father lived in Vienna since 200, 300 years. And there's a lot in my own personality that has to do with Vienna, with Austria. And there is no borderline between Jewish and Viennese. There is a lot that cannot be divided in the two parts. And I
mean culturally.
Culturally, the language, the whole identity. You know, I don't know who I am. I can't answer you the question. Am I Jewish or am I Viennese? Where's the difference?
So that's part of the reason why you've decided to stay yourself.
Yeah, I left Vienna in 1980. I was 4 years in Berlin, 1 year in New York. So altogether, I was away from Vienna for 7 years. Now I am back, and I don't know if I'm going to stay, but I like the town, and I like to stay there, too.
It seems to me it would be much easier to grow up bitter being a Jew in Austria or Germany than it would be being the child of survivors growing up in, say, the United States or in England, because you're constantly surrounded by things that would remind you of the camps and of all the mass murders.
Well, the silence in Vienna, at least till 2 years ago, was also quite comfortable, because nobody talked about the past. Nobody talked about the Holocaust. Nobody talked about Nazis, about war crimes. So sometimes I'm almost glad that it was not a part of my youth.
I guess one of the things you really have to think about, because of your life and because of the research that you're doing, is at what point do people get a fresh start and break with the past, if ever? You know, at what point are you as an individual willing to accept the children of Nazis, and at what point are they willing to accept you? Do you feel that you're any place, or that they're any place close to that point?
I have many friends who come from Nazi families. I think it's a very personal decision if you try to prove yourself and the others that you're somebody else than your parents or your grandparents. And I don't criticize anybody because of his parents or grandparents. The title of my book, Born Guilty, is not a statement that I'm making. It's a statement by one of the interviewers. They feel born guilty. And I only have problems with those who accept their parents, doesn't matter what they did. Then I have problems with them. But it's their own decision. It's not the history of their parents. For instance, Niklas Franco is the son of Hans Frank, who was executed in the Nuremberg trial. He's a very good friend of mine.
In your previous book, your book about young Jews in Germany and Austria today, you wrote that you felt that although you had never been a religious Jew, that you were ready to start living as a Jew. What did you mean by that, and have you acted on that since you wrote that. Has your identity as a Jew changed, or have you been living any differently than you were when you wrote it?
Well, I accepted the history in my family, and which means that there is a cultural history, even if I'm not religious. And I, for instance, I joined the Viennese Jewish community a year ago, and I go to the clubs and I try to meet people there. I go to discussions, which I didn't did before. So I'm more and more interested who are the people, what is going on there. I try to help them when they need me because of the publicity I have now. So this is what I'm doing now.
What effect would you like to see your research have on people in Germany and Austria?
Well, for me, the question was always interesting. Who is the new German? Who is the new Austrian? Is he really different, or is he the same? If you look at all the excuses the war generation gave us for what they did, for instance, like the economic situation was terrible. They had no jobs. They had nothing to eat. What does it mean for the new Germans? Does it mean there are no Nazis because the economic situation is okay? Does it mean for us that we have to be careful when they have no jobs and then when they are hungry? Will they behave like their parents and grandparents? These are all questions. If we want to be sure that there is a new democratic Germany and a new democratic Austria, it means there are new people there with a new democratic identity. But how can they prove? How can they prove us and them that they're really different to their parents and grandparents?
I know you have no answers to these questions. Obviously, nobody can. But what's your gut feeling now to the question of can this ever happen again in Germany?
Thinking about the lies that and all everything that was going on in these Nazi families, it made the second and third generation very difficult for them to develop into other people, which means I'm not so sure, like all the other people, especially the people outside of Germany who think today Germany is a very, very strong democracy. I don't know why they think in this way. Maybe the percentage of democratic people increased from, I don't know what, before the war, 10% to 20% today. But I don't know how the majority would react in a difficult situation in Austria and Germany today. I really don't know. I don't have an answer. And I'm a little bit afraid when the economic situation would change and would be comparable to the 30s and the 20s.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Peter Sokrowski's latest book is Born Guilty, Children of Nazi Families. His earlier book, Strangers in Their Own Land, was about young Jews living in Germany and Austria today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll talk with Michael Nesmith, the only original member of the Monkees who didn't perform in their reunion concerts. He's been busy doing other things, creating the prototype for MTV, producing music videos, and producing films such as Repo Man and Tapeheads. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For William Hamilton, grandeur is an illusion he's been perfecting all his life. But in his novels and New Yorker cartoons, he skewers the pretensions of the rich and the deceits of the wannabes. Coming up, I ask William Hamilton if he would be as miserable as the main character in his latest novel was after marrying into the lap of luxury. When cellist Pablo Casals died in 1973 at the age of 96, he left behind one of the most critically acclaimed series of recordings. The first compact disc reissues of some of these recordings have just been released, and classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. The United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly voted today to register its disapproval of the U.S. refusal to grant PLO leader Yasser Arafat an entry visa. 151 delegates voted in favor of the Arab-sponsored resolution. Only the U.S. and Israel voted against it. Britain abstained. The U.N. is expected to vote possibly tomorrow on a resolution to move the General Assembly to Geneva in order to hear Arafat speak on the recent declaration of a Palestinian state. President-elect George Bush met today with former Democratic presidential candidate Jesse Jackson. It was one in a continuing series of peace meetings with former political rivals. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has details.
The two men met over lunch in Bush's office. An hour later, they came out and talked to reporters at the White House. Bush said he had met several times while vice president with Jackson and had found those meetings helpful. Today, the two men joked with each other, which was in sharp contrast to this year's presidential campaign, in which Bush called Jackson a hustler and Jackson called Bush morally unfit. Among the topics they discussed today, Bush said, reports of a potential furlough for the convicted assassin of Martin Luther King Jr., James Earl Ray.
In my view, that would send the wrong signal to America. And so we had some good discussion of this.
Jackson said Bush is clearly more willing than President Reagan to listen to the concerns of black Americans. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
A group of environmental leaders said they got an enthusiastic and positive reception at their meeting with the vice president today. Bush made no commitments on the environmentalists' proposals, including a gasoline tax of 10 cents a gallon as part of a $19 billion package of new taxes, user charges, and cuts in government subsidies they consider harmful. A study in tomorrow's issue of the New England Journal of Medicine says that repeated exposure to bright sunlight increases a person's risk of developing cataracts, a leading cause of blindness. David Brown has details.
Scientists at Johns Hopkins University studied 800 fishermen on the Chesapeake Bay. They estimated each man's exposure to ultraviolet light over many years, adjusting for such things as whether he usually wore a hat or glasses. Men with the most exposure were three times as likely to develop cataracts as men with the least exposure. As expected, cataracts were more common as the fishermen got older, but at all ages, exposure to sunlight increased the risk of getting them. The study suggests some of this eye disease may be avoidable, says Dr. Hugh Taylor.
If you're out in the sunshine and there's enough sunshine to cause you to get sunburned, then you should really be protecting your eyes. And with a hat and even just cheap plastic sunglasses, you can probably reduce your exposure to less than 5 or 10%. And that's quite significant protection.
In the United States, about 1 million people a year have surgery for the removal of cataracts. For National Public Radio, this is David Brown reporting.
The Commerce Department today reported a 1.8% rise in personal income last month. It's the biggest increase since October of 1987. The White House called the report good news, but private analysts like economist Frederick Dixon point out that the October figures were distorted by one-time income supplements like farm subsidy payments and auto worker bonuses.
You get substantial increases in payments to farmers in 1 month, which certainly boosts the income figures the next month, that you're likely to see a drop-off in that. So I would not expect to see in the month ahead anything like the type of growth that we've seen in income. It should be up, but you're not going to get the 1.8% increase next month in income that we had this month.
Personal savings also rose last month. The personal savings rate as a percentage of after-tax income was 5.2%, up a full point from September. Shuttle managers say there's only a 20% chance that the weather will be good enough for tomorrow's scheduled liftoff of the Space Shuttle Atlantis. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Pablo Casals was the first and most popular cellist to record the major cello repertoire. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is surprised it's taken so long for any of these recordings to be reissued on compact disc. But finally, they have.
Pablo Casals was not only one of the most profound musicians of our century, he was also a moral force, even in non-musical matters. He left Spain at the end of the Civil War in protest against the fascists and took a vow of musical silence. He made no public appearances after that until 1950. He was a great teacher. He taught that a musician must serve the music, that playing music was a selfless, spiritual quest to discover what lies within it. You can hear his integrity, his passionate honesty in every note. There's no self-indulgence. Even his most passionate outbursts have a kind of austerity. His cello doesn't always make the prettiest sound. It has a dark edge. It growls, it bites even as it caresses. But Casals's astonishing rhythmic vitality transcends the glamour of mere tone. His emotional directness allows you to follow a work's essential structure. Every phrase sings with meaning. The first CD versions of Casals playing the cello have finally been released, and they immediately become the most important cello recordings to turn up on CD. One of these releases is no surprise, the complete set of Bach's 6 Suites for Unaccompanied Cello, issued on 2 separate CDs on Angel's wonderful new batch of budget-priced great recordings of the century. They are probably Casals's most famous recordings. He was practically the first musician since the time of Bach to take these works seriously. Casals studied them for 12 years before he played them in public. Till his dying day at nearly 97, he would practice a Bach suite first thing every morning. And he was the first cellist to record them all. These performances, recorded in the late 30s, remain a kind of spiritual testament, besides being the most exploratory, the most moving, and also the most playful versions ever made. The other Casals issue is more surprising. Philips Records, in its excellent Legendary Classics series, has reissued a pair of rare live performances of Beethoven trios, The Archduke and The Ghost, from later in Casals' public career. Perhaps the greatest Archduke on record is the one Casals recorded 30 years earlier with his famous collaborators, pianist Alfred Cortot and violinist Jacques Thibaud. This one, from 1958, with Mstislav Horzhavsky and violinist Sandor Vey, is far from its most refined performance. Yet it's still remarkable, witty, buoyant, clear, and compelling in conception. The Ghost, recorded in 1961 with Vey and Carl Engel, is even more astonishing, especially the literally haunting slow movement which gives the work its nickname. I wish that Philips's digital noise reduction system had left some of the atmosphere of the short-lived LP version. The CD sound is harsh and dry. Still, there's no competition for this little-known and devastating performance. Welcome, Maestro Casals, to the world of modern technology.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. One of William Hamilton's most popular cartoons, a man in a tuxedo at a well-appointed dinner table says to his companion, "Money is life's report card." Hamilton has been issuing his own report cards on the rich and social climbers in his New Yorker cartoons and his satiric novels. Hamilton has told many witty personal stories in his commentaries for NPR's Morning Edition. His new novel, The Lap of Luxury, is about a painter who marries into money. But instead of feeling liberated by not having to worry about money, he's miserable. I asked Hamilton if the book is in any way about himself.
I suppose, obviously, any time anybody writes a novel, it's autobiographical in a way. And I have never married a rich girl, but I've certainly thought about it. And I never trusted my motivations. So it was a way of to exorcise them.
So you thought of marrying a rich girl, never had the opportunity, and now you're trying to convince yourself that it's a lucky thing you didn't, right?
That's exactly right.
So you had the opportunity, is that what you were trying to say?
Yeah, I just never quite trusted myself. I always wondered, I think it would be a very ambivalent position to be in.
Why? I mean, that certainly comes across in the book, but why do you think it would be so hard?
Well, you'd wonder, I suppose it has to do with old sex roles and so on, whether you were the man of the house or a lapdog.
Well, the character in your book thinks that, well, it'll be great and there's all the stuff you don't have to worry about once you have all this money, but on the other hand, he feels like... He's ending up being dragged into the ancient family rut by the oxen of his wife's fortune. What kind of rut were you afraid you'd end up in, marrying into money?
The ancient family rut of my wife's oxen. unless they weren't in the agricultural. I don't know. I just have a feeling that the power in a family, you know, its patterns and so on, would go to the richer person.
Are you from money yourself?
Well, I'm from a distant whiff of it. It's pretty funny. I just did a commentary, which you may or may not have heard, a few days ago.
On the sapphire.
Right. And in that, I compared my family's wealth to the Kashmir mines, which were discovered in 1893 and gave out in the 20s. So I have a lot. I mean, I've seen a lot of monogrammed inherited stuff, and my own parents, I always used to say that in their lives, all they bought were food and toilet paper.
Well, did you grow up with the manners and customs of the rich, even if you didn't have that much money?
I guess in a way. I mean, we always ate in the dining room and that sort of thing.
As opposed to the kitchen, yeah. Right. That always seemed like a sign to me also. But what did you wear for dinner? Did you change clothes?
We wore simple farm-like clothes. Didn't dress up much. God. Now, that was a mystery, too. For instance, my father had lots of suits in his closet, and they would allude to some life that he led other than, you know, ranch life, which was obviously work clothes. And you just imagined these suits and spats and walking sticks and opera hats and everything that were in all the drawers as part of a wonderful life that maybe you could get into somehow, but never really managed it.
It seems like it would be almost schizophrenic to, on the one hand, have these really expensive objects around you and have the sense of belonging to a moneyed family, but on the other hand, to not have any money.
That's true. That's true. I remember writing a furious letter home from... I went to Andover, and I wrote a furious letter home of, how dare you send me to this prep school where everybody's rich but me? And yet, you know, I liked being there. It was an ambivalence that I suppose eventually, you know, came out as fiction.
What were your youthful ambitions? Did you paint, write?
I drew. I got my first rejection as a cartoonist at the age of 12.
That's really young.
Yeah.
What was the cartoon?
It was. It showed two thieves climbing out a window, and I sent it to the Saturday Evening Post. And because of this old inherited life, all our magazines at home were from the 1890s. And it was kind of, you know, I kind of cribbed a cartoon from an old Life magazine. Life used to be a humor magazine, as you may or may not know. It was all full of cartoons. So I sort of redrew one in modern dress.
Were those old magazines around your house the inspiration for your interest in cartooning?
I think so, yeah. They're quite fascinating. They're still there. And the illustrations are wonderful. And I suppose that's why I draw kind of more old-fashioned or something.
Well, you know, your cartoons are very easy to spot in The New Yorker because they're drawn very differently than anyone else's. It's slightly more realistic. The suits are colored in,
right,
which you seldom see in The New Yorker. You seldom see large areas colored in.
I know. The other boys go for the gray blobs. I realized that if you're going to get attention on a page, you have to use a lot of black, because if you look at a photograph, it's almost 90% black, you know, and your eye goes right to it.
Well, that's interesting.
In a newspaper or something. So it was just a feverish attempt to be noticed.
You were described in the New York Times in a book review last week as a New Yorker cartoonist who also writes.
God.
What'd you think of that?
I don't know. The New Yorker cartoonist is a kind of a phrase that it just, you'll never get rid of it. I guess it's like being a former communist or something.
Well, it's nothing to be ashamed of.
No, not really.
I mean, not being a former communist isn't necessarily something to be ashamed of, but I mean, being a New Yorker cartoonist.
No, I know, but it's an amazingly powerful title, New Yorker cartoonist.
Mm-hmm.
And they say it every time they say my name most of the time.
Well, you are still, in fact, cartooning for The New Yorker. But do you think of your writing or your cartoons as taking precedence over the other?
The thing I like best is writing plays. And I like to write. I mean, it's fun to write a novel. I enjoyed that. But it was mainly because I wasn't getting anywhere in the theater. And now it looks like it's moving again. But that's my favorite of everything I do.
Why?
I don't know. It's just wonderful. For instance, if you write a novel, you can't imagine how thrilling it is to hear every one of your words spoken with an audience sitting around you. You know, you don't get that in writing novels. People say they liked it or they didn't like it. And you can't live through it with them. I mean, for the ego, there's just nothing to beat it.
How did you start cartooning for The New Yorker?
I mailed cartoons in from the Army, and they started to buy them.
From the Army?
Yeah.
What were you cartooning in the Army?
Genteel life. Wishfully, far away in a barracks in Alaska. Yeah.
Do you remember the first cartoon they accepted?
I do. Gosh, I guess it's fairly symbolic. It showed a couple of bums, and they were looking at it. There was an advertising slogan at the time saying, "You have a friend at the Chase Manhattan?"
Uh-huh.
And one bum says to the other, "Not you, Charlie."
So when you came back from the Army, you had more of a steady place at the magazine?
Well, when I got out of the Army, I had won some money in a poker game, and I had $200 from the New Yorker, and I just came to New York with it and walked in and said, "Here I am." And they were kind of amazed. So they began to give me $100 a week to draw. They weren't necessarily buying anything. And I, you know, drew and drew and worked and worked. And then I discovered it was all a loan and that I owed them $5,000. And eventually I paid them off. But, I mean, it's a curious place, sort of like an old southern plantation before the war.
You know, on the back cover of your book, The Lap of Luxury, there's a photo of you looking very, very wealthy.
Good.
You're posed with your arms crossed and a very kind of satisfied smile on your face. You're wearing what I guess is a gray pinstripe suit with kind of wide lapels and a little probably monogrammed handkerchief in your pocket there.
Yeah.
And there's a very elegant mirror behind you that has something written on it in Latin, is it? I mean, did you really want to give the sense of wealth on your photo?
Well, I try to give it off every day, but I'm afraid there's nothing in the pockets of that well-cut suit.
Now, why do you want to give the image of being wealthy?
I don't know. I guess it's part of my attitude towards life of looking swell and not having any money. It's nice because you don't have the agony of being rich, but on the other hand, you look like you are. Or something. I don't know. It's getting away with something, I suppose.
You told us earlier that you had decided against marrying for money, or marrying money. If you became independently wealthy by writing, say, fabulous plays or best-selling novels.
That's what I've been trying to do all my life.
So you'd like that, right? You'd
sure.
like to stop impersonating wealth and actually live it.
Absolutely. Yeah, uh-huh. I'd like to be able to afford myself.
Okay, well, thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, so long.
William Hamilton's new novel, The Lap of Luxury, is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and you can find his cartoons in The New Yorker magazine. Hamilton is also a commentator for NPR's Morning Edition. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following for us?
Well, from Moscow, we hear that things have been even worse, even more violent than we'd thought in the exchanges between Azerbaijanis and Armenians. The Soviets have admitted there were 11 more deaths than have previously been reported in fighting in those southern republics. Also, a report from New York on the Starrett City housing project in Brooklyn, and what the court's decision overturning its racial quota system is going to mean there and for other housing projects around the country. And we hear about developments in Chelsea, Massachusetts, near Boston, where Boston University is about to take over their school system.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are many cautionary tales that circulate about jealousy and revenge. Some of them are true. Some of them are just urban legends. Here's our urban legends expert, Jan Harald Brunvand.
The popular urban legend about someone filling a car with concrete sounds like something that could have happened, and many people have assured me that they know when and where it occurred. But so far, this story has been impossible to trace to its origin. Here's the story as I first heard it in 1961 from a woman in southern Michigan. Her family owned a ready-mix cement business. She told me that it had happened to a man working for another company in a nearby town. He was a cement truck driver on his way to a delivery, and he happened to go through his own neighborhood. To the man's surprise, he saw a new Cadillac parked in his driveway. He parked his truck, walked quietly to the house, and looked into the kitchen window. There he saw his wife talking to a well-dressed stranger, a man. Outraged, the driver backed his ready-mix truck up to the house and dumped a load of wet concrete into the Cadillac through a roll-down window. That evening, he came home to find the solid concrete Cadillac was being towed away and his wife in tears. She explained that she had saved for years to buy him the car, and just that morning, the dealer had delivered it. I soon learned that folklorists had been recording the same legend all over the country since about a year earlier. Even now, about once a month, somebody sends it or tells it to me as a current legend that is going around. I've heard several versions of the story from Europe. In each, the wife is said really to have a lover. In some of the English versions, after filling up a car parked in front of his house, the ready-mix driver hides nearby and watches to see what will happen. Eventually, the man he had seen talking to his wife exits the house, hops on his bicycle, and rides away without a glance at the ruined car. In Norway, the story appeared in several newspapers in 1973. In these, the lover's old Volkswagen Beetle is filled with concrete through its sunroof by the husband. The story was finally traced to a cement truck driver who had heard it some 3 years before. Many Americans who tell the solid concrete car story say that they think that it was reported as a fact in a newspaper, but they never have a clipping or an exact date to prove it. So far as I know, a factual newspaper story about the incident has appeared only once. The Denver Post carried news stories on August 5th, 6th, and 7th in 1960, describing a dispute between two men over a $20 bet. One of them, a cement truck driver, filled his pal's car, a 1946 DeSoto, with concrete. The ruined car was left parked in front of the ready-mix company, where many Denverites saw it, and a photograph of the car appeared in the paper. A brief version of the Denver newspaper's account was distributed nationwide by the Associated Press. Do we have the origin of the urban legend here? I don't think so. First, notice that this story differs in that it makes no mention of marital infidelity, and the car is an old clunker, not a new Cadillac. Besides, the solid concrete car legend had been collected by a Texas folklorist in April of 1960, 4 months before the Denver incident. The driver in Denver might have heard a version of the story and decided to act it out in real life, or the incident could have been a hoax perpetrated by the ready-mix company for publicity. The Denver incident probably helped give the urban legend a burst of popularity, but we should look for the true source of the story more in human psychology than in newspapers. Our legendary truck driver, jealous of his wife's supposedly well-heeled lover, attempts to gain his revenge, but his jealousy backfires.
Jan Harald Brunvand is professor of English and folklore at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, digging for dinosaurs. John Horner was the first paleontologist to find an intact dinosaur egg in North America. The dinosaur nests he uncovered revealed new insights into the parenting and social behavior of dinosaurs. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Everything is Different Now, the latest album from Amy Mann, and Till Tuesday, a loose grouping of her musical friends. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Tequila Sunrise, the new thriller about a coke dealer who can't escape his lucrative but lethal trade. It stars Mel Gibson, Kurt Russell, and Michelle Pfeiffer. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Lisa Bruton directed today's show. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.